everywhere I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. This is Shane R. Monroe, and you are listening to Retro Gaming Radio, the June 2012 edition. Welcome to the show. Well, it's summertime, and as always, summertime makes the show harder and harder to get done. So hopefully this show won't actually be late. But I suspect it might. Yeah, summertime, my family's home, harder to record. My wife stays up later. It's just the way it is. But let's get rid of the elephant in the room now, shall we? I was planning on having an interview with Robert Brolia of the .mu fame on the Android and iOS platforms. He's the guy responsible for pretty much the top-shelf emulation on mobile devices, and we actually did record an interview. However, as it tends to happen with some of our interviews, he got a little wordy on a couple of areas that he was concerned about playback, and he wasn't satisfied with the show, and we always give our interviewees the final say. So since he was not pleased with it, we are going to go ahead and scrap it. We're not going to air it this month. I do apologize, and I only built a show to support having an hour-long interview. So this is going to be another short show, and I do apologize again for that. He assures me that in the future we will get together and redo the interview, because he had a lot of great things to say, but he didn't want to worry about having to do an edit and a mixdown and all that sort of thing. So we're just going to scrap it for this month, and we will pick back up with that another time. So I apologize. One of the things that people have asked is Retro Gaming Radio going to attend the Classic Gaming Expo this year? The answer is no, namely because financially speaking, it costs a lot of money for me to attend the show the way that I'd like to. And the Classic Gaming Expo folks at one time had offered me to come up a position to come up and do a keynote speech. And I thought about doing that, actually. But then again, the problem is if I'm up there, then I want to run a booth and I want to see my listeners and I want to sell DVDs and all that other stuff. So it's just not going to happen this year. But if you are planning to go and you're a fan of the show, I would love for you to get business cards from developers who may be interested in being on the show. Someone you'd like to hear interviewed here, if you'd like to be sort of our remote correspondent to meet and greet over there and pass out the business cards and offer up Retro Gaming Radio as a forum for their plugging of current and retro gaming stuff, then by all means, that would be great. We would like to have some kind of a presence there, even if we can't be there ourselves. And finally, to wrap up the introduction this month, Monroe World is the sort of the centerpiece of the Retro Gaming Radio past. Pretty much my entire world revolves around Monroe World, which is essentially why it's called, I know, Monroe World. Not to sound arrogant, but it's Monroe's world. So anyway, that's sort of the hub where we talk about Retro Gaming Radio, Passenger Seat Radio, any sort of special shows we put out. That's sort of the hub. And the forums there, as some of you new members have realized, it can be hard to get membership on Monroe World, simply because we don't have any sort of automated method for you to sign up. You can sign up, but you still have to wait for somebody to turn on your account. And before I turn on your account, I verify you're a human. And this whole process can be a pain in the butt, and I am sorry that it has to be that way. But the second I release that rein, we're instantly flooded with tons and tons of spam. And I can't have that for the current users. Not fair to them. So if the easiest way to get on Monroe World is to sign up and then send a private message to the administrator, which is me, and say, listen, I'm a human. Will you please sign me up and process my account, because otherwise I'm going to have to get around to emailing you, and then you're going to email me back, and I'm going to turn you on, and then say, yes, you're authorized, blah, blah, blah. So it's easier if you bestow upon me your humanity ahead of time. And then I'll get you, I promise you, I'll get you signed right up so that you can join us. Also, most of us in my immediate circles, and especially me, we spend a lot of time on Google+. It is, I think, I'd like to call that the more distinguished social network. You know, I know there's a lot of Facebook fans, a lot of Twitter fans, and that sort of thing. And we do have a presence on Twitter. But in all reality, the people and the quality of the people that I have over at Google+, the types of controls we have to mute, and everything about Google+ works for me as a social network. Everything I've ever wanted to do on a social network is done on Google+, and I like that. So a lot of us are maintaining a lot of our time around there. So if you'd like to hop on, we post classic stuff, modern stuff. We talk about just about everything. So please join us at Google Plus as well. If for some reason you don't want to get involved in the Monroe World forums, or of course, if you drop me a line on Google Plus, then tell me you're a human and what your user account name is you created. I can also authorize you that way. So that sort of takes care of, shall I say, new business. So this month, since we no longer have the Robert Broglia video, Broglia, there's no G in there. The G is silent, if you can believe it. I am going to have some reader mail that I'd like to read. We're going to continue our anniversary series this month with the Atari Lynx, one of my favorite handhelds of all time. I've got a generous bits and bytes section. We're also going to have reviews of A-Lynx, the Android emulator for the Atari Lynx. It seemed to be fitting. And we're also going to do a review on Cardinal Quest, which is a multi-platform, old-school rogue sort of game. And I think you're going to love that. And I'm sure we'll slip a couple more things in there. So hope you enjoy the show and stick around for all the good stuff right here on Retro Gaming Radio. We actually had some good reader mail this month. I picked out a couple that I'd like to read for you. First one comes from George Crowles. I hope I pronounced that right. He assures me, you can back up Steam games. It's not easy, but you can. I don't know if it's the same as buying a boxed game, and you can't trade it or sell it, but at least you can play it in 20 years. And he gives us a link to the steampower.com knowledge base article. And P.S., sorry to tell you that you're wrong, but I thought it would catch your attention. And the joke behind that is the header said, Shane, you are wrong. Of course, that caught my eye. Well, I think what George might be missing is the fact that while you can back up the medium, you still have to authenticate online to play. And the whole problem with that is, as I mentioned before, any service or any product that requires online authentication puts you at its mercy. In other words, if Steam ever goes away, everyone can say, hey, no, Steam's not going to go away. It's going to be here forever. We'll tell that to the people who bought music at Walmart's music store. Tell that to the people that are playing video games on EA's servers that have recently closed down. Nothing's forever. And and let's be honest, in video game and technology, forever is a lot shorter of a time period anyway. You know, what's hot today is less, you know, a month from now is going to be dead. So my point is nobody thought MySpace would go away either, right? And gone it is. I mean, it's still kind of around, but you know what I'm saying. My point is that when you're at the mercy of any product that you own requiring server-side activation or some form of intervention, then at some point in time, you will no longer be able to play that game or use that product. And I'm not supportive of that concept. I'm not supportive of Steam and its ilk. I just don't believe in that. If it's something that I can pay and download, like, Legend of Grimrock, right? I don't own the box of that. I can't sell it. I can't give it to anybody. I purchased it. It cost me $11.99, but I have a copy of it, and I literally have a copy of it on a CD, and I can install it anytime I feel like it on any computer that I feel like it, whether it's connected to the internet or not. And that's the way things should be. Find some other way of combating piracy, because the honest truth is no matter how much, you know, you put on the title, no matter what you do to a title, unless you make everything revolve around the server like Diablo 3, it can be cracked. It's going to be cracked, and the only people that get pissed off are the legitimate consumers that have to jump through all the hoops. So anyway, thank you, George, for writing in. Not exactly what we were looking for in terms of archivability and playability later, but thank you again for writing in. David Thiel, he's that sound engineer that we interviewed a few months back. Great guy. he wanted to give his feelings on one of the shows, the September show. Let me see here. Let me just read this verbatim. It's easier. This may be old news, but I was listening to the September podcast, and I'm compelled to mention this. The retro game philosophy is alive in Halo, ODST, and Reach. When I decided to put my hat in the ring and start working again, I needed to do a survey of the industry. I got an Xbox, PlayStation, a bunch of games. I mostly hated them. First-person shooters with elaborate stories are not satisfying, so I was glad when I got Pinball Work. In the background, I kept checking games out. I got the Xbox 360, and I got Halo ODST and discovered Firefight Mode. It's kind of buried amidst a lot of options. I will describe it more if you have not tried it, but basically it's a retro gaming experience with Halo assets. Player versus game AI in endless waves of ever-increasing more difficulties. Sound like Robotron? No, not exactly, but I get your idea. Never invoke Robotron, ever, because Robotron is a sacred thing. You know, to be like going to a religious or a Christian person and saying, well, you know that guy over there? He's really great. He's a lot like Jesus. It's the same kind of idea. Bungie did not invent this experience for most first-person shooters, but Firefight is the first great fun I've had since Centipede, Robotron, or Missile Command. I've only heard three of your shows, so this may be old ground, but it's a significant breakthrough for retro gamers. The other bonus is three-person cooperative against AI enemies using Xbox Live. I've burned a lot of hours with ODST and Reach. I just thought I would mention it. Well, you know, David, I can't comment specifically on those titles. It is not unusual for an occasional modern game to throw in some faction of a classic mode or a retro mode or something that feels like a score attack. That's what we call it in my circles. We call these sort of games score attacks, where there really isn't an end. You play until you're dead, and there's a lot of games that have that sort of feel to them. Unfortunately, it's not market-driven to do that, right? You get it if you're lucky, you know? You get these games as unlockables, as hidden things inside of other games. Geometry Wars was hidden inside of Project Gotham Racing, and, I mean, if you want to talk about something that's Robotron, with a lot of amazing weird ass vector graphics thing. Yeah. I mean that's a great example of that concept taken, but it wasn't a game. It was a nifty little throw in that they threw in the back door, sounding a lot like this Firefight Mode. They have a lot of new first person shooter games, especially from Treyarch, feature something called Zombie Mode, where essentially you protect a fort and the zombies come after you. You kill them for as long as you can, but in the end, you're toast. That's actually become a phrase in the community, Zombie Mode. Even if it's not zombies you're fighting, it's the same kind of idea. And Gears of War has one of those. My best friend here in town, Justin Mays, he's told me all about Gears of War's, what did they call it, Monster? No, not Monster Mode. There's some mode in there which is exactly the same thing. So, anyway, there's a mode to it, but let me give you an example for Robotron. Robotron is not just about score attack. There is a magic around Robotron and similar types of games that and it revolves around greed is what it is. And score attacks without greed really aren't the best score attacks, right? Zombie mode in the Call of Duty games, there's not a ton of greed in there. There's a little bit, but not much. Robotron is the perfect combination of frantic arcade action, mass score attack, and the ultimate in greed. Because let's be honest, you can run through a wave of Robotron and score very few points, or score a decent amount of points. But if you know how to do it, and you're willing to put your butt on the line, you can score a ton of points in Robotron just by being greedy. And the same thing with Zookeeper, or one of my other favorite games, Mr. Do. My favorite games that have stood the test of time for 20, 30 years are the games that have the insane amount of greed in them. And there are many of them. And unfortunately, for you really to get the greed factor, it's really hard to get a modern game, even a hidden unlockable in some new modern game, that has the greed. I'm not sure developers know how to do it anymore. You know? I haven't seen, take any game, modern game, there was a mode in, I think, Modern Warfare 3 called Dog Tag Mode. That's the most recent thing I've seen that offers something, and it's not even a great greed variable, but it's the right idea. And the greed variable in there is when you kill somebody, when you frag somebody, to use the vernacular, when you frag somebody, you don't get the kill unless you go and pick up his drop dog tags. So you can't sit up on a mountain, you know, the side of the mountain, clip these guys off with a sniper rifle. Then you got to run down and pick up the dog tags. That's a decent example of trying to incorporate a factor of greed. Unfortunately, it still doesn't hold a candle to Robotron or Zookeeper or Mr. Do or any of these other games that are truly about greed. And like I said, I don't think developers really know how to make greed games anymore. The last really good greed game that I saw, well, I'm trying to even remember. There are plenty of Score Attack games out there, but most of the time you get Score Attack, but no greed. And usually greed comes with Score Attack because that's whole part of the whole deal. So anyway, thanks, David, for letting us know. And again, I do agree with you that they have attempted to wrap some of those play modes into the modern games. But unfortunately, as even David mentioned in the email, it's buried, it's hard to find, and a lot of times they don't spend a whole lot of time throwing it together. It's a bonus, you know, it's something that the developers put together in their spare time, and it ended up being an unlockable in the game somewhere. And again, that's too bad. I wish that we could somehow re-harness the concept of greed. And again, occasionally you'll run into some Xbox Live indie game or some PS3 mini game or something like that where it's actually Geometry Wars 2 had some great greed. Pac-Man Championship Edition, fantastic amounts of greed in there. That's the most recent pure greed game I've ever seen. That I've seen lately, I should say, is Pac-Man Championship Edition. And unfortunately, they've kind of expanded and taken that game as far as it can go. The 5-minute challenge is as good as the game gets. And now, after you've played it for about 30 or 40 hours, which I honestly can say that I have, you get to the point now where you're literally shaving points against seconds, and it becomes more of a game of, if you play it until you make a mistake, and if you make a mistake before 4.5 minutes in, you stop, restart. It's like Flick Golf on Android or on iOS if you've ever played it. You know, you're at a point to where if you don't get 5 hole-in-ones in a row, you got to stop and restart. And that's when games stop being fun. So the developers need to figure that one out. But thanks again, David, and thank you, George, for writing in. Again, please, we love to hear your letters, whether you agree with us or not, whether you agree with me or not, or if you just have, comment or idea that you'd like us to talk about. See how much the discussion that just David's letter fostered? Write us in, send it over to, you can send it to Bits and Bytes, or you can just go to the website and hit contact us and send an email in there. We would love to talk to you. This month's editorial commentary is called Red to Blue, How Nintendo Killed One of My Favorite Games. Now, it's not uncommon, or at least it was not uncommon, for Nintendo to artificially muck with an intellectual property to make the property conform to its rigid standards of quality. Now, most of us know that Nintendo will pretty much license any game to anybody to play on Nintendo systems these days. If not, Ubisoft would be out of business. But the honest-to-God truth of it is, in the old days, Nintendo was very, very much a stickler for what got put on their systems. We all remember the original Mortal Kombat. They took the blood out of the system, and they made either it was sweat or they took it out completely. So the, quote, best version of Mortal Kombat on a home platform actually was the best one without blood. They let that go in Mortal Kombat 2 after, I'm sure, sales were completely atrocious once the word got out that the title wasn't selling. But that is not the only situation where, in terms of blood or sex, that Nintendo will censor out. There's actually a ton of examples, and most of you know what these sort of situations are, but I'm going to give you just a couple. Obviously, things like nudity, Some games have pixelated breasts, and those were removed. Some of them had suggestive clothing. Some of those are removed. Sometimes entire covers of the games are changed just to make it more friendly for the American market. There were also things like religious symbols, crosses, crucifixes, symbolism like swastikas were removed, and of course, blood, gore, any sort of heavy hardcore violence was shunned by Nintendo. But the good news is while Nintendo has opened the floodgates to crappy software on their system, forget about the Nintendo seal of quality, doesn't exist anymore. But the good part about that is that we're no longer under Nintendo's rule in terms of, well, you can't show breasts, you can't say the S word or the F word. They pretty much just let anything go right on through anymore, which is a good thing in some respects. However, recently, Dragon's Lair Trilogy came out on the Nintendo Wii. The game featured Dragon's Lair, Dragon's Lair 2, and Space Ace. Now, Dragon's Lair 2 has always been sort of the redheaded stepchild. The honest truth is, Dragon's Lair 2 is really hard, it's really fast, and it just doesn't quite have the spirit of the other two games. It was definitely the third one, even though it's Dragon's Lair 2, it was still after Space Ace, and it just didn't feel the same. But forget Dragon's Lair 2. Dragon's Lair, as you know, if you've listened to this show for the last 10 years, you know that Dragon's Lair's often been hoard, rehoard, rehashed. It's the ultimate in the double dip game. Unfortunately, Dragon's Lair is also one of the games that is hardly ever presented properly. Digital Leisure, who good friends of the show, by the way, so I don't mean to sound like I'm bad-mouthing them, but in all honesty, accurate emulation is not Digital Leisure's strong suit, right? They believe, and probably rightfully so, that the market generally doesn't care if Dragon's Lair emulation is perfect. For those of us who do care if it's perfect, we can go get Daphne, we can rip our own DVD video versions of Space Ace and Dragon's Lair, and we can play them fully emulated on our PCs, and I think that's what a lot of them do. But for the casual player, the ones that remember Dragon's Lair from their childhood but never put like $8,000 into a Dragon's Lair or Dragon's Lair 2 machine, I think that Digital Leisure feels that it's good enough the way that they've put them out. And like I said, I suppose that's probably true. However, every now and then we get a version of Dragon's Lair that you can really tell, because they farm it out, right? You know, they don't have, I don't know if they actually have in-house coders or not, but I do know that Dragon's Lair is often, especially like the mobile versions, they are handed out to an external group, and sometimes the external group goes the extra mile, and it becomes more accurate. Not exactly accurate, but more accurate than previous versions. And there's a whole other story about Dragon's Lair that at some point I'll tell you with regards to the Nintendo DS version that I was actually an associate producer on, if you can believe it. But that's a whole other story that I'm saving for a whole other show. Suffice to say, though, that Dragon's Lair on the Wii via the Dragon's Lair trilogy turned out to be a remarkably decent addition. Sure, there were plenty of problems with it, as with every version, but it's the closest I've seen to a home version being really, really good. They use the remastered video, the ones that they cut for the Bluetooth. It's all cleaned up. It looked fantastic. So, as it goes, that's probably one of the best home versions of Dragon's Lair that you can get. But now, those of you who know me personally, or know me from the show for a long time, know that Space Ace is my baby. I talk about Dragon's Lair a lot, but when it comes to Laserdisc games, Space Ace is my game. I love everything about it. I love the bitchy girlfriend. I like the randomly morphing into Dexter versus Space Ace. I love everything. It feels Don Bluthy to me. I like the comedy. I like the breaking the fourth wall on the death scenes. I like so much about it. It's just one of my favorite games. And anyway, so after taking Dragon's Lair through the paces, I was ecstatic to play Space Ace. If Space Ace was even nearly as close as Dragon Slayer was, I was in for a real treat. And I'll tell you what, Digital Leisure, I mean, I hate to keep going on and on about this, but Digital Leisure did such a top-notch job on this package. The presentation, the menus, the move icons. When you turn on the move helper guide, it's absolutely fantastic. I'm telling you, the Wii version of Dragon's Lair, the Dragon's Lair trilogy is like the least spoken about greatest game you could probably play on the Wii, aside from maybe some of the light gun shooters, because the Wii's really good at that. But if you're a Dragon's Lair fan, you have to have it on the Wii. It's just that simple. All right, enough of my gushing. So I got into Space Ace, and I'm sitting here playing it, and it's like, oh, this is awesome. This is great. The video, the quality's great. The sound is excellent. Until I get to the first Energize. For those of you who've read my review, I know this is going over some old territory, and I'm sorry. But the review's pretty old, so most of you probably haven't read it. When he energized this, if you remember Space Ace, when he energizes, the screen flashes red and he hulks up into this big giant Space Ace guy, right? That's like the whole deal. So he energizes, he turns from dorky, goofy Dexter into big giant Ace and he starts whooping some butt, right? That's the premise of energizing, is to just boom. Okay, so. Now that we got that out of the way, what does the Nintendo version do? Now, for those of you who are watching the RGR Plus TV, I've recorded this video for you, and you can see exactly what I'm talking about. In the Nintendo Wii version of Space Ace, when it starts to flash red, it does not flash red, it flashes blue. It's really like somebody, and literally, it's literally like you're playing the game, it's vibrant, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous, it's like the best version of Space Ace you've ever seen, and then as soon as you get ready to have that Energizer warning, somebody takes takes a pair of like 3D glasses, except for having one red and one blue, take the one red out and make them both blue. So this is a simulation, you can load up Space Ace, get a pair of these glasses on. Get ready. As soon as they start to energize, throw the blue glasses on. That's exactly what it looks like. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? I thought maybe, you know, did I have a bad copy? Or, I mean, what's going on? This is incredible. So I energize, and as soon as you're done energizing, you go back to the regular color of the game. So it's like the entire game gets a blue tint until you're done energizing, and you're back in the game. I'm thinking, okay, maybe I didn't just see what I saw. Maybe I'm just totally screwed in the head. So I continued playing the game, and again, the next time I energized, and every single energize in the game is blue. Now, here's the sad part. If this was some subpar piece of crap, worthless version of Space Ace that had all the errors in it, that were still problematic, that didn't let you do the alternate scenes, blah, 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 I wouldn't care, because then this wouldn't be the biggest problem with the game. Unfortunately, as I played and I realized just how good of a game it was, as these renditions go, mind you, I became more and more upset that for some reason it was blue. Now, I wrote to Digital Leisure initially when I reviewed the game and said, listen, can you set me hip why this is blue? Because I'm about to release my review. And I would rather have a good answer to put in this review than to just bash the crap out of it. I mean, this is a fantastic product with this one exception. And I didn't get a response back. So normally Digital Leisure is really good. The mail probably just slipped through the cracks. I don't know. But, you know, I had a personal deadline. I wanted to get this off my plate. I put the article out. And it hasn't been until recently, you know, within a couple of years or so, that I've really said to myself, you know, I want to play some Space Ace. And I fired up the Wii, and I'd totally forgotten about the blue, to be honest with you. I started playing, and then the blue popped up, and it just I started seeing red. I actually saw red instead of blue, only because I was so mad. So I wrote to Digital Leisure again, and I said, you know, I just went back to Space Ace, and it's blue. Can you tell me what's going on? So anyway, Paul, the guy over there, my contact, he wrote me back and he said, Well, because I'd ask him, I said, because Dragon's Lair had just come out on Android, and then Space Ace hit iOS. So I wrote him, I said, iOS, come on, you're killing me. My heart's breaking here. I need Android Space Ace. And I said, preferably red this time and not blue. And then I said something else, and I remember. Anyway, he wrote back and said, no, it's red, not blue. And he said, Nintendo made us do that. Or, no, I'm sorry, wait a minute. Nintendo forced us to do that. But that's all he said. And the way he said it sounded like he wasn't going to tell me the reason why. So I wrote him back and I said, are you kidding me? Nintendo made you do it? And I said, I can't think of a single reasonable reason why Nintendo would make you trash your IP like that, because it totally ruins the experience. And so I fumed on it. You guys know how it is when I get pissed off at something. I started fuming. I started writing this big Nintendo, and I did actually send the nasty letter to Nintendo before I heard back from Paul. And I was just, this so sucks, you know? It just bothered me. It just kept bothering me and nagging me. I know, like I should care, right? But I was just, oh, this is just making me crazy. So I sent off the nasty letter to Nintendo, told them I thought they were, you know, I won't say what I said. This is the family version of the show, not the passenger seat radio. Suffice to say, I wasn't happy. Anyway, enough of that. So anyway, they wrote me back, and essentially he said, this was after a couple more email exchanges, and by the way, nothing back from Nintendo. Apparently I don't rate that. Anyway, so he wrote back and said, the flashing red of the Energize. You probably know where I'm going with this. Nintendo apparently runs the games against some sort of an epileptic seizure meter. And apparently it ran into the, quote, dangerous zone for epileptics. And I'm thinking to myself, well, wait a minute. I've seen video game after video game that says, you know, may cause seizures. They have warnings. You know, that sort of thing. And I would think that it would have been a real pain in the butt to go through and do, what, 15 or 16 Energize sequences and remaster them in blue. I didn't push the issue, of course, but I'm still upset about it. And I said, well, how did you get away with it on the 3DS? You know, on the DS, the Space Ace on DSiWare, it's red. Every other home version of Space Ace I've seen is red. And, you know, Nintendo had to have approved the DSi one. You know, I've never once and I have been with the Laserdisc games, the Don Bluth legacy, whatever you want to call it. I've been part of this since the beginning. So you're talking about, what, almost 30 years. Or 30 years, actually maybe more than 30 years at this point. I don't know, I'd have to do the math. My point is, I've never once at an arcade seen any kid freak out playing Space Ace. I've never seen any home version or even heard of any home version causing any sort of seizure or lockup. And these things are huge. I mean, all you'd have to really do, I mean, okay, so let's say that it's a danger meter. Okay, so if that's the case, wouldn't you say, well, listen, you know, how many reports do we have from the arcade version, from the CDI version, from the PC version, from the DVD version, from the Blu-ray version, all of these different versions? Have you ever had anybody actually report an epileptic seizure from this? No. Okay, then you need to put a warning on the box. Done. It'd be done and over, you know, just in case. Cover your butt, that sort of thing. But then it really got to me, because I really feel that for some reason this was, I don't want to say it was personal, because of course it wasn't, but it seems personal to me. We've got games that have obviously flashing strobe lights. I mean, look at Pokemon and all these other weird games where you do fights and they flash the background, all these sort of things. And there's always those jokes about, you know, Pokemon causing seizures and all that sort of thing. And it seems funny that all of these other games get through and all these other TV shows that Nintendo has to approve. Nintendo, just for some reason, this one, the thing that I actually care about, is the one that got, you know, censored or clipped. Unfortunately, this is it. I mean, that's not like there's an appeal process or any way that we can get around it. You know, the best that I can do, and I actually intend to do this at some point, is I can disassemble the Wii disc, okay? And I have a pretty good idea that on the Wii disc are standard movie type files. I'm sure they're not MPEGs or anything easy, but I'm sure the files on there can be replaced. And I've got the means to do it. So at some point in time, maybe I can disassemble that disc. I can take my own movie files of the actual Red Energizer and put them in there. Maybe there's some way I can do that. I don't know. But it seems so sad that one of the best versions of the home game, best home versions of the arcade game, is only available in a weird, goofy blue version. So, that's my story. That's how Nintendo killed one of my favorite IPs, one of my favorite games, by forcing Digital Leisure to turn Red Energizing into blue. And if you haven't seen the video, if you're not watching the RGR Plus TV, by all means, it is posted on the Wii 60DS YouTube account. So go to youtube.com/Wii60DS, and you'll be able to find that video. I uploaded it, so I think I uploaded it. I don't remember. Anyway, we'll get you a link to it. No problem there if you don't have an opportunity to see it. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed the editorial commentary. Join us next month for my opinion on something that'll probably piss me off, but that's the best type of editorial, right? This month we are going to be paying homage to the Atari Lynx. It's almost 25 years old. It recently celebrated its 20th anniversary. And I personally have a rich history with the Atari Lynx. Let me give you the backstory, because everyone loves the backstories to these things. I was in the Navy in late 80s, early 90s, from, let me think here, like 88 to 95, is 7 years. So is that right? 88 to, yeah, 7 years. So I was in there from 88 to 95. I was aboard a fast attack submarine. And for those of you who may know anything about that, space is tight. There's no video game consoles on board, and your own personal storage space is very, very small. So the concept of handheld video games was huge for the sailor, because we had the ability, the lack of ability of storing or bringing anything with us. We couldn't bring our computers. We couldn't bring anything. You had this, you know, 6x3x5 inch storage facility, and that was pretty much it. So, initially, I picked up a Game Boy Classic, the black and white Game Boy. And it was kind of nice because it had Tetris with it, and there were other guys on the submarine that also had a Game Boy, and so we could link up and we could play Tetris together. We did a lot of that. And it was good, but let's be honest, right? The Game Boy original black and white was one of those things you love to hate, or you hated to love, or how did that work? How's the expression go? Love to hate? I mean, you loved it because there were all these licensed titles kicking around, right? You could get Mario Brothers, you could get Kirby, you could get Tetris. You know, you had those things. And I had probably 8 titles maybe? Something like that. I had like 8 titles for the black and white Game Boy. Alleyway, a Kirby game. I finished the Super Mario Brothers game a couple of different times. But overall, it was good to kill time, but I didn't love it, I guess is my point. Well, then the Lynx came about, and believe me, when I saw the Lynx and that color screen, here's part of the problem too. When you're in your bunk and the curtain's drawn, there's a little tiny light, and the light isn't all that good for playing a non-backlit video game. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could get those little afterburner-type kits that you can put over the top or whatever, the Game Boy light. It's just like, how much of that crap do you want to tote around? But the Lynx, why, that's backlit. I could play this in the dark. That was huge to me. That was like the biggest selling point, that I could play it in the dark. Because you're in the dark a lot when you're in your bunk and sleeping, or in the, you know, lights are out, whatever. Your whole area is shut down from lights, and, you know, you don't want to have to use that little overhead light. Playing in the dark just sounded like it was the bomb. So initially, I picked up the Atari Lynx. I can't remember. There was another good story around that, but it's just totally eluding me right now. There was something weird about how I got the Lynx. I either hawked something. I don't remember. Anyway, so the first couple of games that I owned were, of course, the Slime World game, which I think I got as part of a pack-in deal. Klax, which is a fantastic puzzle game, and Road Blasters. Now, if you've never played Road Blasters on the Atari Lynx, it's like as close to the arcade as I've ever seen, and it's fantastic. At this point in time, though, I own about 60 or so of the 120 games that were made. There were like 86 original games before like the homebrew people started making games, or demos, or PD-ware, that sort of thing. So commercial releases were somewhere like 85, 90, somewhere in there. And of those, you know, there's probably 30 games that you just have to have. I mean, it's just like, wow, this is incredible, I can't believe it type of games. So I own about 60 games altogether now at this point. Someone had asked recently, since the Atari Lynx emulator came out for the Android, somebody had asked, what are the best games that you can get on the Atari Lynx? And I said, well, I'm saving my list for Retro Gaming Radio. So now you get the list. These are in no particular order, mind you. Actually, I think they might be in alphabetical order. But it doesn't matter because these aren't necessarily my favorites. I'm sorry, in the favorite order. Right. So Blue Lightning, California Games, Chips Challenge, Gauntlet Third Encounter, Joust, Klax, Lemmings, Ms. Pac-Man, Paperboy, Elvira's Pinball Jam, Road Blasters, Viking Child, and Xenophobe, Zybots, and Zolar Mercenary. Now you'll notice that like half of that list are arcade ports. And they were really good too. Joust is incredible, Ms. Pac-Man's incredible, Paperboy, incredible. Road Blasters, incredible. Xenophobe, Zybots, right? All arcade translations, so those worked out well for me. But there were some incredible games that just, you wouldn't even think of how addictive these games would be. Chips Challenge is a perfect example of a game that you would look at, and it was like one of the lower priced games too, because Atari games were expensive. And you looked at it and you go, man, why is this like $19.99 and everything else is $29.99, you know? And it's like, well, I'll pick it up. I don't have a lot of cash. It'll give me something to do. And I'll tell you, Chips Challenge, I don't even remember how many hours I played of that, but it was a lot. Elvira's Pinball Jam. Now, I'm a pinball slut anyway, so I love pinball. And that, I think, came with two tables, I think. Elvira's table and then another one. But anyway, it was fantastic. And it wasn't until years and years, probably decades later, that I realized that the Elvira table was a real table. So I actually got to play the original arcade table that that game was based on. So that was really cool. Viking Child, there was another subname to that, Legend of Viking Child or something like that. But Viking Child was sort of a platform RPG adventure game. Absolutely fantastic. Burned tons of time in there. And Zolar Mercenary was your kind of raid-in scroller shooter, lots of weapons. So there were tons of great, great games. And Lemmings was fantastic. Gauntlet was great. California Games. Like I said, these are my top 15 games. If you were to purchase a Lynx, these are the games you should run out and try to get your hands on. Like we did with all the other anniversary series, we're going to talk about the specs and the history of the product as well. This was a 3.5-inch color backlit LCD screen, which was absolutely gorgeous. It still is, actually. I mean, it's obviously dated, and it doesn't look like an iPod or anything, but it's still very, very impressive when you look at it and say, God, look how old this thing is. It uses one of the MOS Technologies 8502 8-bit CPUs, running at about 4 megahertz, which was 4 times faster than the Commodore 64, 160 by 102 resolution. It did feature, get this, 17-player local networking through the use of a Comlinks cable. We're going to talk more about that. One of the things that really set it apart was the hardware zooming of sprites. This was like the Amiga, the handheld Amiga is what it really was. And it's funny because you'll find out later that the Amiga was the development kit for it. But real-time hardware zooming of sprites. You could do some amazing pseudo 3D with that thing. Four-channel stereo 8-bit DAC for sound. 4,096 colors total, but you can only display 16 colors at one point in time. Here's what's amazing. The graphics chip was a CMOS 16-bit high-speed hardware sprites with collision detection, hardware decoding of compressed sprite data, hardware clipping and scrolling, which just, I mean, that's insane to be able to do that on a hardware level. Up to 75 frames per second, 16-bit math coprocessor. The carts range from anywhere from 128K up to about 512K, or half a meg. And you could have a 2 megabyte cartridge, up to a 2 megabyte cartridge, if you're willing to do some bank switching and flipping some memory around. It was powered by 6 AA batteries, and that gave you between 4 and 6 hours of play. A lot of people, the battery consumption on the Lynx was a huge problem. You had the Game Boy Color, or I'm sorry, the original Game Boy, that could run forever on a set of 2 AA batteries. And here's this game that literally sucked dry 6 AA batteries, you know, within a single 1 or 2 play sessions. You could use rechargeables, but you got yourself, you know, 2 to 3 hours of play, like 3 hours of play on rechargeables. Back then, of course, these weren't, these were like, you know, nickel metal hydrates, you know, they weren't like lithium ions back then. It launched in September 1989 for about $180. It was originally developed by the team from Epix. Now, you remember Epix Software? They made the Commodore 64 fast load cartridge. They were responsible for Summer Games, Winter Games, Pit Stop. The Epix team is huge, was a huge deal. And those were also the people that originally worked on the Amiga, which I may have a footnote here about. Anyway, the Epix team, when they built this sucker, they realized that they weren't going to be able to publish it by themselves. They weren't going to be able to push it out and get it out there by themselves. They had a great piece of hardware, but nobody to handle it and handle distribution. So they partnered with Atari to make this happen. And Atari would call it the, would want to call it the Portable Color Entertainment System, right? But it changed to Lynx when it shipped. And I didn't figure out why. I did some research, but I couldn't figure out the reasons why they made the change. The Game Boy itself was announced at the Consumer Electronics Show in 1989 as well for $90, half the price. And Nintendo had the suppliers to crank these out through the holidays of 1989. Unfortunately, Atari could not keep the Lynx on the shelves, right? Through the Christmas time, 1989, the first holiday of any hand or a hardware device, right? At the first Christmas is crucial. You can't run out, as we've seen recently with the Wii, right? You don't run out of that thing. When you got something hot, you do not run out of it. Unfortunately, they ran out. Half the price, a big game selection, units in stock. Not hard to see why Nintendo won. Anyway, to continue, 1990, the following year, was a really good year for Lynx. It actually sold very, very well. Unfortunately, the Game Boy continued to pick up traction, and 1991, you know, Game Boy was kind of in the lead. So Atari said, listen, we need to do something exciting with this product and put it back in the hands of the masses. We've got, you know, we got production ramped up. We're all good to go. So in 1991, they came out with something called the Lynx 2. It was smaller. It was sleeker. It was a lot cheaper. And they took it out of the bundle pack that they were trying to sell the original Lynx for. So Atari did try to learn from their mistake. Unfortunately, right around the corner, Sega jumped on the bandwagon with the Game Gear. Now, what really made the Atari Lynx such a great product was you held up its nearest competitor, which was the black and white Game Boy. Blurry green screen, no backlight, crappy arcade ports, really, honestly. And then you held up the Lynx, this gorgeous, beautiful backlit graphics, it's just insane hardware sprites, the whole bit. There was really no competition. So for the tech people, the ones that really wanted the high-end stuff, they wanted the most power they could put in their hands, the Lynx was a no-brainer. And I think that's what kept it going. But never bet against Nintendo, especially in the handheld market. Ask Sony. They know all about it. But 1991, Sega came out with the Game Gear. Now, all of a sudden, we have another color backlit unit. It actually cost more. And it ate batteries just as fast as the Lynx. And unfortunately, Sega had some amazing titles. They had a lot of developers that jumped right on board and started pumping out titles. And let's be honest, if you've ever played the Sega Game Gear, and some of their big name titles are very, very stripped down, poor games. The Lynx games were far superior. And they were far superior and better ports as well. Unfortunately, you could no longer hold a blurry green screen handheld up in one hand and a beautiful, gorgeous color screen on the other hand. You had to actually hold two nice looking screens up and say, where are the games that I want? And the games were on the Game Gear, which was too bad. In 1994, Atari shifted its focus to the Atari Jaguar and basically said, well, if the Lynx continues to work, great. If not, oh well. Telegames stepped in. Now, Telegames is a developer of... They develop software for forgotten platforms, is really what I would call Telegames. They stepped up and started developing a whole bunch of games in the later 90s. It was a little too late, though. They came out with some nice quality titles, but Atari basically pulled the plug in 1996. It was pretty much over, right? But oddly enough, as things tend to do, the Atari Lynx, much like the Dreamcast and many, many other forgotten systems that had a huge following, the Atari Lynx continued to have software developed for it well after its death, including the previously mentioned Telegames, which created several titles. And many, many homebrew people have created full-blown games for the system, including the last one that I know of in 2009 called Zabu, which we've actually talked about on the show before. So you were already up to date on that. And as always, I like to have some interesting factoids that are a little less than just straight-up historical looks. This was, as I mentioned earlier, created by some of the original Amiga design team, and they did indeed use Amigas for development kits. It was codenamed Handy, by the way, the Atari Lynx, that the Epix group called it Handy. Here's something that I did not know, or I may have known but I've forgotten, but a lot of people do not know. Handy was offered to Nintendo first. Epix went to Nintendo and offered the Atari, well, the Lynx, or the Handy, to them first, and they turned it down. So it's interesting, right, as we watch Nintendo continue to make lower specification hardware, cheaper, lower power constraints, that sort of thing. They continue to do that, and it's continued to serve them well. Maybe, can you imagine, though, can you imagine first-party Nintendo titles on an Atari Lynx? Wouldn't that just be sick? I guess it'd be a Nintendo Lynx at that point, or whatever the hell else they would have called it at that point. Who knows? The original system came with a case. Remember we talked that it came in a pack? It came with a case, an AC adapter, a Comlinks cable, along with California games. And then later on, when they stripped everything out of the unit, they took away all the extras and they just sold the unit, they threw in a Blue Lightning demo cartridge as the pack-in. Oddly enough, for those people who have collected Lynx cartridges, the cartridges themselves changed over time. And I've never heard anything like this. Now, the Atari 2600 had an original cartridge, right? The original Atari cartridge, and almost everybody used that. You'll remember, though, that a couple of manufacturers, developers, publishers like Parker Brothers, Imagic, they tended to use cartridges that looked differently than the original Atari cartridges. I think they were looking for some sort of an identity where you could look at it and say, yeah, that's a Parker Brothers cartridge. That's a, you know, that's Gyrus. That's a Cosmic Arc. That's whatever. And so there was and then I think the Intellivision clones, there was a Mattel created some for the 2600 and they put them in, oddly enough, Intellivision-looking cartridges. However, this is interesting because the morphing over time of the Atari Lynx's cartridges was more out of necessity or practical reasons than trying to create some form of identity. Originally, they were completely flat. They were little flat squares. And I still have a couple of those. And that was designed specifically and on purpose for stacking and storage, right? You could literally stack 50 Lynx cartridges up in one little tiny spot. That'd be perfect, right? Unfortunately, they were kind of hard to get out of the system when they were flat. You know, you kind of had to get a friction build going on your fingers to pull them out of the cartridge. slot. So what they did is they add these little tiny dimples, and they added corresponding dimples to the back side of the cartridge. So there was like male dimples on the top and female dimples on the bottom. So you could still stack the cartridges, but the dimples would give you extra grabbing or extra friction to pull those cartridges out. But even that, I guess, wasn't good enough. They ended up going to what you would traditionally see a Lynx cartridge, which would be flat with sort of a rounded top where you could actually get your fingers right underneath and just pop them right out. So it's very interesting to see the evolution of the cartridge, not for visual acuity, but more for practicality. I thought that was interesting. One of the very unique factors of the Atari Lynx that a lot of people may or may not know is that it was good for lefties or righties. They literally had a second set of buttons that you couldn't remap. I mean, a game had to use the two buttons that were available, but you could flip the unit 180 degrees. You could use the D-pad with your right hand while using the extra set of two buttons with your left hand. So if you were righty or lefty, this game was comfortable for you. And I wish I knew, because I know there's got to be a backstory as to why that was so important. I mean, it couldn't have just been a bullet point. That's a lot of time, money, and energy put into making this thing flip over. Maybe that's why they called it the handy, because it was handy to flip over and use which hand you wanted to use. Boy, that was a tough one. The original unit, the Lynx 1, if you will, had a single mono speaker out, but the Lynx 2 got a second speaker, and then you could start doing audio panning. And a lot of the later games, especially the big games, would actually make very good use of stereo sound. Or, of course, you could use headphones. One of the things that I still have that was absolutely necessary for the Atari Lynx, if you were a serious owner, was what I called the Proton Pack. It was this giant D battery case. It's incredible. This thing's got to be over a foot long, and it can hold a set of 6 D batteries. I mean, you think that those mega lights that cops carry around, those only have like 3 or 4 D batteries in it. This Proton Pack had like 6 giant D batteries in there. But you could get like 12 or 13 hours of battery life off that thing. So essentially what you do is you were supposed to clip it to your belt, but this thing was like half the size you were when you were a kid. So you almost had to like put it on a sling over your back. I mean, it was that frickin' big. Look it up. It's hilarious. But when you were a serious guy, when I was laying in my bed on the submarine, why not? I mean, I didn't have a power adapter in my bunk, but yeah, I mean, I could take a D battery pack and stuff it under my pillow or stick it to the side of my pillow, and I could have 12 hours of playing the game. So while it seemed really goofy to carry around a frickin' unlicensed nuclear accelerator on your back, it was still very, very useful for long play sessions that lent itself. About 5 million total Lynxes were sold, which I think is actually a bigger number than I thought it was. Here's something else that I found interesting in my travels. Games were designed to be loaded from tape, which is funny because the Amiga itself, the development kit that was used for these things, never had a tape drive. At least I never saw one. But the games were designed to be loaded more or less in a burst mode. In other words, instead of actually accessing the code directly on the cartridge, it would have to load the cartridge game into memory to play it, and then when you were changing levels or whatever, it had to load those sort of things. So unfortunately that gave the unit what I would call loading times. Now it ain't nothing like a PlayStation Portable. It takes like 8 minutes from power up to actually playing the game, but in some of the games, you know, you could have a couple of loading screens from time to time. The Atari Lynx was supposed to have a thumbstick controller. A thumbstick controller, which of course turned into a D-pad. I'm not sure which I would have rather preferred for that thing. Obviously the thumbstick would have ruined some of the sleekness of it, and the D-pad was kind of the standard, so I guess they did the right thing, but I can't help but wonder what it would be like to play with one of those prototypes. It is pretty much understood that through with the historians and the video game aficionados, that there was one single thing that killed the Atari Lynx. And it wasn't Nintendo. It wasn't the batteries being chewed through. It was one thing, and that was Tetris. Tetris on the Game Boy was simply, and still to date, probably one of the best Tetrises ever made. The multiplayer version of the game was fantastic, and most people truly believe, if you ask them, if you ask these video game historians, why did the Lynx fail, they'll tell you Tetris. Interestingly enough, only the CPU, the main CPU on the Atari Lynx is 8-bit. The rest of it's 16-bit. So if they'd actually put a 68000 on there or something like that, it would have truly been a 16-bit game system. And a lot of people would argue that if the graphics system is 16-bit, then it's a 16-bit system. But another interesting little factoid here was that, so why didn't they put a 68000? I mean, that's what the Amiga ran on. Wouldn't that have made more sense? You know? So was it a cost issue or what? So I had to go and do some research because I had to know the answer to this one to tell you. The 6502 was chosen over the 68000 for many reasons. The 68000 chip was bigger. And when you're dealing with a handheld, space is everything. Obviously, it was more expensive. And here's something very, very interesting. Code, the same, if you were to write code for a 6502 and do the same thing on the 68000, the code would actually be bigger. So that would have perpetuated a cost increase across the machine. So that means more RAM, more ROM, bigger cartridges, etc. And there are many historians of the Atari Lynx variety that believe this is the sole reason why they chose the 6502 over the 68000, simply because the code was more efficient to be written for that processor. The bus is more efficient, and here's something you also, too. The 68000 at the time was not what they called a custom chip design. In other words, it was the 68000 was more a processor to be put into a particular architecture versus something that could be just dropped into a custom layout. It wasn't until like 2 years later, 3 years later, in 94, I think, so I guess that'd be what, 4 years later, 5 years later, Motorola finally released a 68000 as what they would call a custom chip design, compatible chip that you could just throw into pretty much anything and make it work. Up until then, though, it was very hard to do that. So that's why the 6502 was chosen. You know, the Game Boy was not the only one that had goofy add-ons. One of the problems, one of the interesting problems, and this is still something that goes around technology today, the Game Boy was a lot better to play out in direct sunlight. So if you were outside, much like with a Kindle, or an e-ink reader. E-ink readers are fantastic to read out in the sun. But take your tablet, be it an iPad or a transformer or whatever, and take that outside in direct sunlight and have a good time trying to read on that. Well, the Game Boy, being the black and white unit that it was fantastic in the sunlight. Where it had problems with was in the dark. That's why they had add-on lights and the screen was so small that they had to give magnifiers with lights on them to play those things. And of course the Lynx had a giant screen and it was backlit and it was color. It was easy on the eyes, even in the dark. Well, in the sun though, you couldn't really play the Lynx. So they came out with the most amazing piece of plastic. It was a fold-up design sunscreen that would clip directly to the Lynx 2 that you could close the sun visor on it. But when you were playing, you'd lift it up and it was almost like a little privacy shade. You know, have you ever seen privacy shades where it blocks like three sides? You used to see this like on monitors for the government monitors and stuff when they were trying to do something, privacy related. They would have like these screens that it was almost like a wall and a ceiling that extends from the monitor. But you can Google it. I'm sure at this point in time, Alex is already sending you links and videos of this if you're on the RGR Plus TV. But the sunshade was absolutely incredible. I still have one of those. The Comlink system was originally called Red Eye, which is fantastic, especially if you're an old Battlestar Galactica fan. And the reason it was called Red Eye was because originally they were going to use an infrared port for the networking. Unfortunately, as you may have guessed, infrared being line of sight did not lend itself to the greatest In other words, you know, you have to be line of sight with all the people you're playing with. If you try to get 16 people all crammed together in a circle, pointing at each other, they made the smart decision moving to the cable. It worked fine for the Game Boy, so anyway. Interestingly enough, my last factoid, that Comlinks cable, the Atari Jaguar actually has a port to plug your links in. I know what you're thinking. Well, wait a minute. Man, that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about the PSP talking to the PS3. We're talking about the PS Vita talking to the PS3. We're talking about Microsoft, what do they call it, Smart Glass. We're talking about the 3DS talking to the Wii U. And yet here we are back in 1996, and the Atari Jaguar was going to be one of the first ones to do it. Crazy stuff. Well, listen, we'll continue our anniversary series on the next show. I hope you enjoy these anniversaries. I really have a good time doing the research and finding out these little bits of information, even on these systems I know really well. There's always new pieces of information as new people come forward and bring us this information. And hey, you know, we're in this, the next 10 years, you know, 5 to 10 years, we're seeing a lot of great things turn 20 and 30 years old. So there'll be no end to the number of anniversary shows I can do. So I hope you enjoyed this look at the Atari Lynx, and join us next month for another great anniversary right here on Retro Gaming Radio. We have a very fruitful Bits and Bytes this month. Lots of different contributors this month, which is always nice. First up, I'd like to point you over to Project Fedora. Big Finish Games is looking at recreating the Tex Murphy series. Now, I've never played Tex Murphy, so I don't know a whole lot about it. But it's a Kickstarter project. And, hey, listen, as long as we're bringing old games back to the new systems, hey, I'm all for it. So if you're a big Tex Murphy fan, or you're just interested in seeing what Big Finish is up to, jump over to TexMurphy.com. You know, hey, again, you can't go wrong promoting classic games that are getting remade. And that was compliments of Steve Douglas, who sent that in. Thank you, Steve. Next up who sent this one? Oh, this was me. How do you like that? This is a Kickstarter project for something called the Joystick Game Bar. And what these guys are looking to do, as always, is to get funding to create essentially a bar experience that deals with vintage coin-operated games. And they've got a video. They've made their funding, which is great. Again, some of this news gets sent at the beginning of the month, and we end up doing the show at the end of the month. So they were looking for about $7,500 to make that happen, and it looks like they got it. So anyway, especially if you're in Atlanta, this is going to be something you definitely want to take a look at. So check out the video. I'm sure they'll still accept more funding. Most of these Kickstarter projects will continue to accept funds, and check it out. I mean, again, anytime you're looking to promote classic gaming or video gaming or bringing back arcades, well, believe it, I'm behind you. Let's see. Next up, sent to us, again, I've got so many windows open here sometimes. Martin Parrott, of course, good friend of the show, also a regular contributor, sent us over something called Space Invaders OpenGL, which is a, you know how it goes, right? We have classic games, we bring them into some sort of a new format, or we take old games and use new technology. Well, this is a 2D, 3D version of Space Invaders. It's Space Invaders. The game hasn't changed, but they've retooled the graphics. They've put it in some different formats. You can play it like on a 2D you can play it like in 3D space. Hey, you know what? Galaga Dimensions was a lot worse. So, and this is free, so you might as well get in on it. You can download it right away. It looks like it's available for let's see. Looks like you can get it straight for Windows, pretty much any version of Windows, although I'm sure that there's a port of it kicking around somewhere. So, hey man, got to support OpenGL and support classic gaming. It's good stuff. Oh yes, here we go. Super Mario Brothers stop motion fan art. Now this is a guy, You got to, you know what? I'm not even going to tell you about this. Just go watch the video. This guy did a complete Super Mario level using stop motion animation. I've got a personal soft spot for flip animation and stop motion animation, so this was really cool. The interesting part is when you get to the very end, you're wondering to yourself, did this guy remake the whole scene over and over again to make this work, or does he really, really have like a 30-foot stop-motion studio for this? And I'm going to let you watch the video and find out what the answer is to that. But it's cool. It's worth your time. It's worth your time. Obviously, because I'm the one who sent it in. Not saying what you guys don't say. What you guys send in isn't worthwhile. I'm just saying that that's why I had it on here. I sent it in. Let's see. Here we go. Here's another archival project. And I love these things because at some point we're all going to wake up and everything's going to be gone. All the stuff that we grew up with is going to be gone. It's going to be replaced with these digital downloads and nothing we can hold in our hands anymore. You're not going to be able to get a hold of an Atari joystick anymore. Anyway, Zurich student named Werner Randall Sofer. Does nobody have a regular name when I have to do these news articles? He has been archiving the digital artwork of the 80s and early 90s home computers on the web. A master's student in visual computing, he has collected samples from the Amiga, Atari ST, IBM clones, and lesser-known computers like the British Sam Coupe, which is interesting because, while I'm very illiterate in European and British hardware, I've still never heard of a Sam Coupe. I've heard of Amstrad, I've heard of CPC, heard it all, but not about the Sam Coupe. So anyway, so check it out. Like I said, I'm always interested in these sort of archival processes, and what this guy is doing is pretty good. So, hey, you know, considering that he has an Amiga death sequence from Dragon's Lair and the Amiga ball juggler, the glass juggler is the examples on this article, of course I had to promote it. Are you kidding me? All right, next up. Marble Madness is one of those weird, weird games. It's a 3D isometric game where you roll a marble from the start to the end. It sounds pretty basic, but you got all sorts of nasties in the way. You've got ledges to fall off of. It's one of those games that you either love it or you don't love it. Well, interestingly enough, Marble Madness gets a hardcore remix album. Now, you know me, I'm always in for a good remix. And especially when it has to do with some of my favorites from songs from the 80s, or when it comes to a really good video game, or an obscure video game like Marble Madness. I would play a little bit of it for you, but you know, the show's mono and it's low bitrate, which is great for voice, but it's not so, you know what, screw it. Here, I'm going to play you a little bit of it. Let me get something in the middle here that you can kind of get a sound feel for it. Here we go. Okay, you guys get the idea. I'll have to remember to boost that up in post-production. But yeah, so anytime you get something cool like that, I always like to share that. So check that out. Let's see, that was also sent in by me. See here, I said that lots of people sent stuff in, and it's me. Oh, here we go. Gary Adamson sent in a little note, especially for us European listeners, UK listeners. We've got a lot of you guys. The Acorn Archimedes celebrated its 25th anniversary recently. And again, here, I know the name Acorn, but I did not know of anything called Archimedes. So, anyway, apparently there were four versions of this sucker out. It kind of looks like an IBM PC Junior, maybe. Anyway, so I've got a whole article here for you. Definitely check that out. Again, I can't really comment on those guys. Let's see. Oh, Gary also sent in 10 8-bit classics. Now, again, this is a little more slanted to our UK brethren. And I promised myself this year when I started doing the show again that I was going to give you guys a little more time. And this is the way I can do it, is by pointing you to interesting stuff like this. So let's take a look at 10 of the 8-bit classic games according to this article. And you can tell me yourself whether you think these are rather UK-centric or not. Some of these I've never even heard of, but we're going to get through some of these. Ant Attack, Chucky Egg. I've actually remembered Chucky Egg a little bit. Let me run through a couple more of these. We owe our UK brethren this. Elite, of course, Elite's been on tons of stuff. That was number three. Number four is the text adventure Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which, of course, was released on every platform on the planet, so that wasn't really there. Hungry Horus. Now, if that doesn't sound like a UK IP, I don't know what does. Jetpack, another one of those weird games with things floating all over the thing. It's like Jet Set Willy. I don't even remember if Jet Set Willy's on here. Night Lore. Yep, I remember Night Lore. That got ported. Manic Miner. Again, some of these you're just totally going to remember, right? Some of these, Phantom Slayer, and I've never seen that one. Trans Am with a Z, Trans Am. And that was number 10, so I guess we got through them all. Good. Interesting. Some of these, just crazy, especially this Phantom Slayer. Let me read this to you because this looks very interesting. The world's first first-person shooter could be. Phantom Slayer drops you into a windy 3D maze populated by the titular phantoms who will kill you with a single touch. Fortunately, you have a blaster and two or three shots will take him out. The snag, you can't see them until they're in front of you. You carefully step through the maze, pounding heart, ready to leap out. When you suddenly hear, only when they're near, the thud, thud, thud of their treads. Simple, scary, and incredibly addictive. I'd actually like to play that. I wonder if there's a port that I could play on something I have. So there you go. There's Gary Adamson looking after us. 10 8-bit classics from the UK. Next up, we have Androcade 2. Chris Hull sent this in. This is from the Hackaday website. This is a project that is essentially trying to come up with a perfect controller for Android tablets. And this is really cool. It looks like an Android where the tablet becomes the head. And you've got legs that you can lay your arms on. I thought at first that would look really bad. I mean, that looked kind of... These legs are sticking out. You're kind of going, that can't be comfortable. But then you realize you can lay your arms on. It really looks cool. It looks like a black Android, like in a tuxedo almost. And it's got 6 arcade buttons. It looks like a, you know, kind of like an iCade, only properly for Android. So very, very cool. And they got a video there for you to take a look at. Anything to promote the Android platform, I'm all about that. Thank you, Chris Hull. Oh, hey, here's another one from Chris Hull. This is weird. I've got them like all alphabetized by who sent them in. Weird. Mini MAME pinball. Now look at this. Now this is something I just gotta get my paws upon. This is it's a little tiny pinball machine. And it looks like a pinball machine. Remember a long, long time ago, this was back when we were running Classic Retro Gaming Radio, there was a full-size pinball table made out of computer screens and you could play visual pin MAME on it. And visual pinball with pin MAME next to it, but it was huge and it cost like $10,000. It was insane, but you could play like all these games on it. Well, this is like a what do they call them? Not cocktail, but what do they call those little mini ones? Cabarets. It looks like a little pinball cabaret. It's fantastic. You got to check this out. I'd love to get my paws upon one of these things. It looks absolutely great. Congratulations. This is one of my favorite, homebrew hardware projects I've ever seen. So thank you, Chris, for sending that our way. He also sent us over something called, Project Unity. And this is an interesting deal. What these guys are trying to do is they're trying to create a multi-system console made out of like real hardware. So instead of taking like a Nintendo on a chip and trying to force in a 2600 emulator and all of these things onto it, instead of making an emulator machine, it's a console with like 20 actual console boards all rewired to work with a different set of controllers, and it's incredible. I'm not a hardware guy. But check this out. Here's what they've got in the project so far. A Sega SMS, Nintendo NES, an Intellivision, a GameCube, an Amiga CD32, which of course they get mad props, Philips CDI, and PlayStation 2, of course that plays PlayStation 1. They're looking to add to it an SNK Neo Geo, a Sega Mega Drive or Genesis, Amstrad GX4000, don't even know what that is, Nintendo 64, Sega Saturn, Sega Dreamcast, ColecoVision, SNES, a TurboGrafx PC Engine, Atari 7800, and the Atari Jaguar. They're trying to get all of this into one unit. If nothing else, it's fascinating to look at the pictures and what they're doing with it. It's absolutely crazy. It's like the ultimate Frankenstein machine, but they got videos and all sorts of good stuff. So that's fun. I like that. Ah, yes. The Agony movie trailer. This is compliments of me. For those of you who do not know what Agony is, Agony is a Psygnosis game. As you know, Psygnosis is responsible for the greatest Amiga games and some of the greatest games of all time. Shadow of the Beast. What are some of the other things that you would know them from? Lemmings. These guys are it. And they made a whole bunch of fantastic, unique-looking video games for the Commodore Amiga. And if they did get get ported, some of them got ported over. Things like the Killing Game Show and Awesome and Anarchy. I mean, the games go on and on. I mean, Psygnosis. Here's what Psygnosis was. For those of you who don't know who Psygnosis is, Psygnosis was the game company like Imagic. If you could remember Imagic from the 2600 days, was there a bad Imagic game? I don't think there was. I think everything that Imagic put out was top-notch. In fact, you could go to the store and grab an iMagic box, because they were very easily labeled, easy to see. You could pluck that iMagic box out, and you know that when you got home, no matter what the game was, it was top quality. You could buy it sight unseen, plain and simple. Agony was a game put together by Psygnosis that was a side-scrolling shooter. Which, okay, you're going, oh my God, there's like 9 million of those. Granted. But when Psygnosis did something, they could literally, like, read you the phone book and you'd be enchanted by it. They were that good. The graphics were insane. I mean, arcade quality or better graphics. Music, the audio. The music was always top-notch in Psygnosis games. The sound effects, the quality, the presentation. It was like watching and playing a movie in a good way. Agony featured you as an owl flying in a side-scrolling shooter. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And they put together, somebody loved that enough to put together a fake trailer, a movie trailer. So, you know, somebody said, okay, if Agony turned into a movie, this is what the trailer would look like. We've seen tons of these in the past. But to see something for something so, you know, esoteric as Agony, that's just way the hell too cool. So that had to be shared. I ran across something called the NES Bit Magazine, and they've got two of these things. They're a pound a piece, so what, a buck and a half in American dollars. And they look like some decent quality digital magazine. They consider themselves a dedicated retro magazine for all NES fans. I know there's tons of you NES fans out there. Unfortunately, I don't have one of the magazines to give you a review of. Maybe this gentleman, Keith Lettner would like to send me one, and I'd be happy to review it. I'm not the biggest NES fan, or I just buy one. I still might at some point. But he's got two issues out. So take a look. I mean, if it's NES is your gig, then, you know, it's hard to go wrong with classic video material. Okay, so here we go. Disney has put together a new movie called Wreck-It Ralph. And this is, now, I've got a big, big problem with Disney in general, and I have more of a problem with what I call CG animation, which is pure computer graphic films. They bother me. They don't work for me. It's not my thing. I'm a traditional animation guy. So anytime that Disney comes out or anybody comes out with these CG movies, I just take a pass because I know it's going to piss me off. But listen, it's really, really hard not to be interested in this film, and I'll tell you why. The film centers around video games, old classic style video games, and it's all about this guy named Wreck-It Ralph, who is essentially the Donkey Kong of a Mario-type game. his job is to destroy buildings while your job is to fix them with your hero. Anyway, Wreck-It Ralph follows this guy getting a complex. He doesn't want to be the bad guy anymore. He's tired of doing his job and, you know, getting pushed around by the good guy. He goes to a support group. He meets a bunch of other bad guys. It's actually, it looks kind of interesting. I'll probably see it for free, you know, $1 rental, if you will, when it comes out. Probably won't go to the theater to see it. But it's all in pure classic video game format. So anyway, yeah, so go check out the trailer, see if it interests you. It comes out, I believe, November 2nd, and they've got some online games you can play. Like I said, it's all Disney stuff. What I find totally amazing, though, and I'm not sure how this works out, and there's got to be some sort of a law in here, you know, fair use, right? I mean, there's certain, I mean, if you're doing something as a lampoon or a satire or something, then you can get away with using other people's material, but this actually has Bowser in it from Nintendo. You know, that's bizarre. I mean, Disney's not really affiliated with one of the, you know, like with Nintendo or Sega or whatever. You know, but Disney makes their own crap. You know what I'm saying? So I'm really surprised that they managed to get Nintendo to let him use Bowser. There's got to be a good story in there. Maybe that'll be better than the actual movie, is figuring out how they managed to license all that stuff. It's kind of like, remember in Roger Rabbit, you saw Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse on the screen at the same time? I mean, that was just, that's crazy to even imagine something like that. But there was a good story behind that one, too, but that kind of goes above and beyond what we're talking about here. So anyway, that's Fix It Felix. That was sent in by our good producer, Alex J. Lopez. Also, Alex sent us in this. Now, this looks really tasty. Now, everybody's up in arms about this Raspberry Pi, which is, you know, the $29 full computer that runs Linux. Well, not to be outdone, VIA Technologies, VIA, you've probably heard of them. They made motherboards and video cards and sound cards and chips for 20, 30 years. These guys have been around forever. But VIA Technologies has created what they call the $49 Android barebone PC, due out in July. And this is an ITX size board. For those of you who know about form factors, there was ATX before, and then before there was the AT format, and now we have the ITX, which is really good for small devices like Roku type boxes, things like that. Anyway, so this is really nice, $50 for this board, and it'll play very nicely with APC's version of Gingerbread, which is modified to use a mouse and keyboard, and essentially it's an 800 megahertz, 512 megabytes of RAM, 2 gigs of storage space, along with a bunch of standard interfaces, HDMI, VGA, some USB, Ethernet. Wow, $50 for like a full-blown PC. It might be worth getting into. I'd really like to get one of those Raspberry Pis, though. Those are really neat. Again, that was sent in by Alex J. Lopez. Now, here we go. Now, how long have we been waiting for this? And this has just now showed up. Hackers get the Virtual Boy emulator running in 3D on a 3D TV. Right? So, here we go. The Virtual Boy was the first 3D video game. It was all like red and black. It was almost like vector. You could consider it almost a vector game. It wasn't, but I'm just saying it looked like it. Gave you headaches. It was terrible. It's like one of the biggest failures right up there with Microsoft Bob. But it was 3D. And they managed to get a Virtual Boy emulator running on a 3D TV actually in 3D. That's something that you just can't believe hasn't already happened yet, but there you go. Martin Parrott sends us another little jewel. This is interesting. Okay, so if you're a Nine Inch Nails fan, which I'm not, but that's okay. If you're a Nine Inch Nails fan, you may have heard of an album called Pretty Hate Machine. Now, I had never heard the album, but I understand the genre of music. This is the first time I've ever seen anything like this, exactly. I mean, we've all heard of remixes and computer versions of songs and things like that. But this is pretty much the whole album, I think. It's 10 tracks, reimagined completely on 8 different 8-bit systems. So now it's called the Pretty 8 Machine. It was done on a Commodore 64, an Atari 800, an NES, an MSX. Let's see what else was done here. A Sega Master System, a Famicom or NES, a Game Boy, and a couple other systems. Anyway, so they used 8 different machines to recreate a Nine Inch Nails album all in 8-bit. So that's crazy, right? I mean, that's what a neat idea. So if you want to check that out, they do have a digital album available for $6.50 US. And, of course, they do have some demos for you to listen to. Again, man, anything to keep 8-bit alive, I'm good with that. Speaking of 8-bit, here is something from PBS called Off Book. This is a show, and this is a show dealing, I don't know what the show deals with other than video games, but this is called The Evolution of 8-Bit. And so they took a look at, that's about, how long is it? It's like 8 minutes long, and they talk about classic 8-bit graphics, how they evolved, that sort of thing. It's a neat video. I didn't get a chance to finish it, but it's fascinating what they do with it, and they talk about it. They play 8-bit music and things like that. It's interesting. It's interesting. If you're a huge 8-bit fan and they talk about the 8-bit phenomenon, it's worth looking at. It's got cool cutscenes. They show old hardware being pulled apart. It's pretty good especially for an 8-minute watch, so you might as well check it out, right? And of course, again, that was sent in by Martin Parrott. Let's see here. What else was up here? Oh, yes. Atari prototypes. This is, there are a number of Atari arcade prototypes over the years that, of course, never saw the inside of an arcade. Prototyping is a very common deal with hardware manufacturing, and while there are tons and tons of released equipment running around that you can get your hands on, there's a lot of prototype stuff that just never quite made it. So there's a whole bunch of examples of hardware, software, videos. You could probably spend a good hour and a half just pouring through this website. They show you things like Marvel Madness 2, which they made like, what, 2 of them, and the one guy wouldn't give up his ROMs. There's a whole big story behind that. Remember that one? And they show you hardware that never made it. It literally, like I said, I mean, if you're at all into video games, arcade games, and who isn't listening to this show, so much to look at on that page. So definitely check that out. And let's see, the last one comes from Gary Adamson, again, our great regular contributor. He sends us over a new Ocean website. Do you remember Ocean? These are the guys that gave us games like Rambo 3 and Platoon and Rainbow Islands. They did all the RoboCop ports. My God, they did so much stuff. And Ocean was one of those love-hate things. A lot of people hated Ocean. A lot of people loved Ocean. But believe me, at one time or another, if you've been playing games for more than 5 years, you've probably played an Ocean game. Things like Whizball, they did a lot of publishing, right? So they would bring in games from overseas, both sides of the pond, as I recall, and they would publish the games locally. So they were kind of like Atlas is now. You know, they'll bring over the games that the publishers don't think will work on the other side. But they've got all sorts of stuff. They got media galore here. I mean, if you just want to get completely blown away, they've got an entire selection of loading screens, right? Is that crazy or what? So you can go here, go into media, loading screens, Commodore 64, and you can sit here and look at tons of their screens from the Commodore 64. And they got just metric buttloads of these things. It's insane. Let's see, Combat School, Cobra. Oh, my God, how horrible. Cool World, Decathlon, they released Donkey Kong on the Commodore 64, Double Dragon, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, that was a crazy game, it's another one of those Euro games that, boy, I'll tell you what, Yeah, let's see what else we got in here. Man, there's just so much stuff. They did a Highlander game, Hudson Hawk, Hunchback of Notre Dame. That was actually a pretty good game. Hunchback the Adventure, I guess. I could go on and on. And they have it not just for the Commodore 64, but they have it for, let me see, what else did they cover? ZX Spectrum and Amstrad. So don't think this is like a Commodore only site. There's plenty of stuff to look at. I played a ton of Ocean games, and I know I'm not alone. So this is fantastic. So they've got advertisements that you can look through, magazine covers that featured Ocean products. It's literally like the ultimate Ocean site. You know, if you want to relive Ocean and all of their glory, what a great site. I wish every big conglomerate. I wish Psygnosis had one of these. I wish Electronic Arts had a site like this where you could go back and look at Mail Order Monsters and look at all those, you know, the great stuff that they did before they got all crapped out. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for Bits and Bytes. Actually, it was one of the longer segments this month. Good stuff. Remember, these all come from you guys. Occasionally, I'll find something and I'll stick it in the box. But for the most part, this area of the show is populated by you. So send us an email, bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com. Send us in your Bits and Bytes submission. It can be news. It can be an article. It can be a video. You know, anything that would be of interest to our listeners. You know what you like. Maybe the rest of the listeners like that, too. So send it in. Even if we've already got it, we appreciate that you've sent it in and taken the time. And we love to get your submissions. So please submit as much as you like. We love it. And if we don't get to your submission 1 month, sometimes we have something in the pipeline that we want to do that would be better to have it featured in a future month. So don't think we're eliminating it. It just might show up later. Well, hope you enjoyed this month's Bits and Bytes. We'll be back next month with another giant Bits and Bytes right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Not really so much of a review, but I would like to mention the A-Lynx emulator for Android. It is an Atari Lynx emulator, and after all, I just gave you 15 great titles to look at. The A-Lynx emulator is still a bit rough around the edges. It's obviously not a Robert Broglie emulator, so it definitely needs a little bit of tweaking. It needs some finesse, and it really needs some optimization. Part of what makes the Lynx game so great is that they were smooth, fast, and sleek, and they played a lot like their arcade counterparts. Unfortunately, right now, even on some of the best Android hardware around, it still doesn't quite run as fast as I would like it to run. So it's worth watching, though. It's worth keeping an eye on. They do have a free version you can check out before putting your money down. And definitely add your thoughts to the Google Play Store if you purchase it or download the free version. Let them know you'd like to see some optimization. I would really like to see this one bloom because, frankly, I think the Atari had some of the greatest ports, and I'd love to have an opportunity to play with those again. But, you know, sometimes you just can't quite play it at the right speed. It just doesn't feel right. So if you're interested in exploring the world of the Atari Lynx, however, as simply for a purely educational process, and you're just looking to see how the games looked and how they performed, just understand that the A-Lynx product will work just fine for you as an evaluation tool to take a look at games, give you an idea how they played and what they looked like, but it's definitely not running full speed, and I would be concerned that you don't want to base all of your Lynx exposure based on the A-Lynx package. Hopefully it'll improve, and if it does over time, I'd be more than happy to give it another review and look it over. But it's fully functional. It works. It's just a little slow, and over time, I'm sure the optimization we'll get taken care of, and we'll have a really good Atari Lynx emulator. I'll tell you what, we're starting to run out of great systems to emulate, and I'm looking forward to a time when we can have full-speed Atari Lynx, and we already got a great Game Boy emulator now, thanks to Robert Broglie. We have a full-blown GBA emulator out now. So GBA.mu, it's worth me mentioning. Definitely check it out. It's a $4.99 purchase off Google Play Store. It's available for iOS as well. So for those of you running on Apple products, you can also enjoy. I'm assuming you have to be jailbroken for that. I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming so. Because I don't think you can buy emulators in at iTunes. You'll have to do it from the hack store. Was that Cedilia or Cedilla or whatever it is? So anyway, but that's available. So definitely check that out. Give Robert Broly all of your money, as much money as you can, because I would definitely want to try to convince him to work on a Commodore 64 emulator at some point, because God knows we need one badly on the Android platform, one that's really good. Also this month, I wrote a full review of it after I put this on my list. So the honest truth is, instead of talking about it in great detail for the next, you know, 20, 30 minutes, I could really just send you a link over to my full review that I wrote at Review Lagoon, which is where I post my reviews. But I'm going to give this a little bit of time because I believe it's important. If you've already read the review, you might as well just skip it because I'm just going to cover the same stuff. But if you haven't read the review and you don't know about Cardinal Quest, let me tell you about it. First of all, I'm a huge classic RPG fan, meaning I'm not talking about classic RPG being Chrono Trigger, okay? I'm talking about classic RPGs being Telengard, right? Rogue or Hack, Temple of Abshai, what are some of the other ones? There's a ton of them. I mean, there's a ton of these classic move around the dungeons, Rogue, Hack, Net Hack. You've seen all of these, and they're all sort of the same deal. You walk from room to room. There's monsters. You fight them. You pick up the loot. You level up. You get better powers, and you finish exploring the dungeon. You find the staircase down. You go to the next level. Wash, rinse, and repeat. It's either you love that kind of game or you don't love that kind of game. Personally, I do. This game is called Cardinal Quest. Cardinal Quest is available on numerous platforms. For sure, I can tell you it's available on Android, and it's also available as a Flash game on the Kongregate gaming site. It's really easy to find it. I do find that the Android game is a little more comfortable to play. Just because with Flash, you got to kind of click around. It's easier to touch. Or, as my friend Chris Henschel likes to point out, if you happen to have an Android with a keyboard, it's even easier to play with a keyboard. Essentially, it is just like the games you grew up with, the Hack and Rogue. You run around a dungeon. You get to pick from either a fighter, a wizard, or a thief. And each one has sort of their own delightfulness about them. If you play a fighter, obviously you've got prowess, you've got more health, you've got more stamina. That makes Cardinal Quest a little more arcade-ish. Because as you run around the rooms, you engage melee combat just by running into a creature or an enemy. You can pick things up by just walking over them. So literally, playing a fighter, you can haul butt around this dungeon, and they're randomly generated, so you'll never play the same game twice, which is fantastic. I love that. As you run around, it's the standard deal. You've played this game before. You'll pick up better armor. You'll pick up money. You'll pick up a better sword. You'll pick up a better ring. You'll pick this up. You'll pick that up. Most of the maintenance, though, is all done automatically by the game. So if you pick something up, it'll tell you right on the screen, oh, I've already got something better than this. I'll put it in my pack, right? So it's got some auto maintenance to it, which is kind of nice because sometimes some people love just switching out armor, boosting armor, blah, blah, blah. But sometimes you just want to kill stuff. And that's how this game works. If you play a thief, you have to be a little more stealthy. You got the backstabbing thing to do. You've got a whole different way to play the game. If you're a fighter, you can literally run around arcades. It's almost like Gateway to Abshai at this point. You can run around and be as fast as you want to be, not really worry about it. Casting spells or skills is really a secondary thing for the fighter. The thief, you've got to work a little bit more. And then finally, the wizard is not an arcade player. You've got to move him around. You've got to be careful. You've got to set up your spell shots. You've got to set up your melee shots, if you're going to even do melee with the wizard. You've got to set up all of your spells. Essentially, you've got 5 slots for potions at the bottom. And you can stack multiple potions, right? So you can get like 10 healing potions and they take up one slot. 10 mana potions and they take up one slot. 10 strength potions and they take up one slot. You get the idea. So you got 5 potion slots and you've got 5 skill slots. Now, skills spells, they kind of merge together, right? So wizards can cast fireball, they can cast invisibility, they can cast blah, blah, blah. And you get the spells by picking up scrolls as you run around the dungeon. As a fighter, you pick up different spells than, say, a wizard or a thief. But again, it's like skills call them skills. And you get five slots, but you can carry more than five. You just have to change them out before you can use them. And you can get healing. There's it's an amazing assortment of skills that you can pick up for a game like this. I played it for hours and hours and hours, and I was still finding new scrolls and new types of spells to use. Now, unlike other games, when you use the scroll, it really just puts it in your inventory, right? It's like you get the spell, and you don't use it, and it's gone. But you do have... you do have regen times for each spell, and the regen time, it varies from spell to spell, right? And it's not real time, but if you sit around too long, the world will move around you. So you can't play it like a pure, turn-based RPG, but you've got a lot of time. You can just kind of sit there and do nothing, and no, you won't have a turn, or your spells won't regenerate. But after a certain period of time, I never really did the math on it, but it's like 20 or 30 seconds, a move will happen in the world. And your spell will regenerate one little piece, you know, a monster will move one step, even though you don't do anything. But it's still pretty much tactical in that respect. I mean, it's not like if you sit still within 5 seconds, you're dead. It's not going to happen that way. You've got time to think. And as long as you keep doing stuff, the world won't move around you. So you get the different spells, and with the wizard character, you really have to spend a lot of time setting things up. You get five or six guys chasing you. You've got to work your way into a cavern or something where they can't all attack you at once. The enemies have magic too. They have ranged weapons. It's all line of sight. You can't see around corners, right? So if you run around a corner, then the enemy disappears and you don't know where he's at. Did he follow you? Is he going to follow you? Some of them do. Some of them don't. You can cast things like charm spells where you can make the monsters fight for you. It's all standard D&D type stuff. Now, as you go down the dungeons, as you examine the place, it'll map it out for you. You don't have to manually map. And you can bring up your map anytime you feel like it and see where you're at. Now, here's the great part. Every game should do this. While the map is up, you can still move around. You see yourself on the map, and you can see any monsters that are in your line of sight, but you won't see other monsters on the map. So it's really nice, after you've cleaned out all the monsters and you're going around looking for goodies, or you're trying to do a full completion of the dungeon before you go down a level, because you grind, right? You don't want to go down two or three levels as fast as you can, even if you find the stairs right away on each level. The further down you go, the harder the monsters get. So you want to make sure that you grind a little bit, get your replacement equipment, and get yourself leveled up before you jump down to the next level, right? So even if you find the stairs right away down to the next level, you still want to spend some time running around the dungeon. Now you've cleared the dungeon, there's one or two rooms left. You bring the map up and you run around like real time in the map. It's fantastic. It's the way it always should be. And of course you can't see the whole dungeon at once. You see like the room you're in, or, you know, like a 10 by 10, you know, tile area of it. It's like I said, it's pretty standard, but at the same time, it's so classic in feeling, the way that you play it, the way the graphics look. There's very little animation. It's all still. It's classic. It's one of those games where if you love 8-bit old RPGs, if you played a lot of Telengard, if you played a lot of Temple of Abshai, you're going to be right at home here. There's a handful of other things too you'll have to worry about, of course, as well. Namely, you've got two problems: health and lives, right? This is an old school dungeon crawler, okay? You don't have like five lives. You don't just automatically go back to the last save point. You don't even have save points. This is a, much like Zombie U that we've heard from Nintendo this last E3, this game you play until you're dead. Yes, you can save your game any time, but when you save, you quit. So it's a one-slot deal, and there is no regeneration. Now, occasionally, sometimes, if you're lucky and the moon aligns with Mars, you may find a heart which will grant you one life, one extra life. They're rare, You're not going to find them very often, so treat each life as if it was your last, because it probably is. There are no achievements or trophies. There's no end result. There's no storyline. If what you're looking for is some sort of a Diablo 3 experience, this ain't it. But if what you're looking for is old school roguish experience, then you can not do worse. Wait a minute. You can't do better. There you go. You can't do better than getting and playing Cardinal Quest. Now, like I said, try it out. Try out the Flash version. See what you can do with it. And then go out and buy it, because I want this guy to continue to develop this. And as I said in the interview, the review here, there's a couple of things that are kind of missing here that the game could be so much better with. The guy's asking for $2, all right? $2, that's less than the price of my coffee in the morning, okay? So what's wrong here? What are we missing here? Well, we're missing a way to track your game's accomplishments, right? You want to see, what was the highest level you achieved? What was the deepest level of the dungeon you got to? What's the most gold you accumulated? There's no history or metrics, which means now there's no score attack. There's no way to say, well, am I doing better or worse than I did last time? You know, how many monsters have I killed? Just something to let you chase a score or a stat would make this game 10 times better. It'd be cool if you could share these accomplishments with your friends somehow. Not just the basic, I played this game on, you know, get sent to Twitter. I played this game. Shane is playing Cardinal Quest and leveled up to level 1. You know, don't do it that way. But there's got to be some way we can do this without being annoying, right? I think a lot of my friends would play it if for somehow we could put together some faction you know, some ranking system or something that we could do to make the game more competitive. Something else we're missing. I'm gathering gold. I'm selling stuff. Okay, I'm not really selling stuff, but as I get stuff I don't need, the game sells it for me and I get gold. But what can I do with the gold? I mean, you earn it and it goes up, but there's nothing at the end of the day. You can't buy something. You can't buy yourself a life. You can't buy yourself health. So what's the gold for? Also, give me some incentive, right, to search the whole dungeon. If I clear the whole dungeon and I map everything, give me some sort of a bonus. You know, if I kill all the monsters, give me some little thing that says, you know, all monsters killed, something. Throw in a treasure room for me to pilfer if I do something good. There's some great things they could steal from Gateway to Abshai, which maybe hide some of the doors, right? So we have to use seek spells or something, or a reveal spell to find them. I'm a completionist when it comes to these levels. I like to find the whole dungeon. You could make this a buddy experience, right? You could have you and a friend, let's not get carried away, two people's probably more than enough, that you guys could run around the dungeon together. Split up, right? You know, Scooby and I'll go this way and Fred and the girls will go the other way. And, you can tag team and, you know, root out these heavy infestations of monsters. And of course the game would level to make sure that if you're playing with two players that the game is fair. I think that would be great. And then you could have a couple of friendly competitive pieces, right? That treasure room, sort of like on Gauntlet, right? Whoever gets the most treasure and gets out of the room in less than a minute, you get to keep your treasure. Something like that. There's so many different ways that you could expand this game while still keeping the classic means of play. Now, here's what I do not want the developer to do. Don't turn this into a quest game. Don't turn this into an RPG with a storyline and specific missions and side quests. Keep it roguelike. This is perfect. But look at this. I've given you tons of options that you can do to expand this gameplay without spoiling the fun of a standard roguelike deal. So, that's pretty much my overview of Cardinal Quest. I cannot recommend it enough. Listen, this is Retro Gaming Radio. This game epitomizes the concept of what we as retro gamers look for and want to play on our devices. So, don't hesitate. Go find a way to play this game. Play it on the Flash. Play the Flash version. If there's a version for iOS, which I think there is, go get that. If you're an Android owner, pay the frickin' $2. Let's get this guy some money so that he will continue to expand on this concept, because I absolutely love it. If you want to read my full review with pictures and all that good stuff, go to ReviewLagoon.com. And if you're on the RGR Plus TV, of course, you're probably already getting it. So make sure you go check that out. Believe me, you want this. You want this. Let me just leave it that way. That's going to wrap it up for the reviews this month. I know we could do a little bit more with this, but there's only so much time in the day for us to come up with this stuff. So I hope you enjoy it, and we're going to have more reviews for you next time on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, listen, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. A couple things before we go. I do want to let you know we are on Twitter at Retro Gaming Radio with no O at the end. Sorry, they have a limit to how long your name can be. We're on Google Plus. Look for Retro Gaming Radio there. We are also on Shoutcast. You can listen to classic episodes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for free right on the Shoutcast server. Go to shoutcast.com. Search for Retro Gaming Radio, or, of course, use your favorite Shoutcast streaming tool. It also works on mobile devices, so you can listen to classic RGR all the time. Of course, RetroGamingRadio.com is the official website. Oh, and for those of you, many of you have written saying, please, please, please bring back the links from the show, because we can't watch the RGR Plus TV, so we're missing the sites that you reference and the links that you reference. It's almost done. We have to do some retooling of the back end of the website, which has already been done, and all of that's already in place. It's done. It's working. The problem is we have a whole bunch of shows that do not have the metadata they need to provide you with the link to send you. So while I've got all the coding done and everything, we still have to go back and retrofit all of the data files that drive the older shows. Once that's done, I can turn it on, and you guys can go back and listen to old shows or bring up link lists to the videos as well as the links that we mention very easily right on the website. So your pleas are being heard. It's almost ready to go. I was hoping to have it done by showtime, but retrofitting the shows takes a lot of time. Alex has been really busy. I've been really busy. So we're hoping to have that done in the next few days, hopefully past the weekend. Within a few days, we'll have the links all caught up for the shows, and we can flip that option on for you. So we are hearing your cries, believe me. And we're going to get that done for you. So please be patient. Be patient. It's almost done. And, of course, the last but not least, the only place that this show makes any money at all is selling archive DVDs of the show. If you're a fan of the show and you want to pick up the old episodes, like the old classic episodes, they're available on DVD. You can go to RetroGamingRadio.com, order right online, order with PayPal, and you get a nice little package with that. We have cheap editions for the starving students where you can buy just the shows without any of the fluff and cool interfaces and all that good stuff. So there's a couple of different pricing options for those of you who want to pick up the old shows, support the show. Yeah, I mean, we pay for everything else out of pocket. So it's not the job of this show to make money, but, you know, hey, pay for our web hosting bill, pay for our syndication service, Libsyn. It's up being about $8-$9 a month for that. So anything helps out. And we don't want to take donations or contributions or whatever. We'd rather, sell you something that you can use, something that is worthwhile that you can get something out of. So. Well, listen, gang, I hope you enjoyed this month's episode. Join us next month for more great Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane Armin Rowe saying, until next time, keep it retro.